Welcome to another episode of Stuck at Home with my man, Barry. Barry, I have not seen you in person for over a decade now.
Is that true? That's insane.
Yeah, I know. I was still doing Gig Home when I last saw you.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Well, where are you stuck at home physically?
I'm in San Francisco.
All right. So there's a few thousand miles between us.
You're still in Long Island, right?
Yep, I'm on the North Shore of Long Island. We want to snobbily make sure people know that we're not hanging out with that South Shore trash. By the way, this is a joke in my office because my three partners all live on the South Shore, and they all come up to the North Shore to have dinner because the restaurants by me are much better. So it's pretty amusing.
Everything with Barry is better. Come on. So what have you been up to lately? You know, how's the pandemic lockdown treating you?
So everything in the world these days seems to be binary. And I divide people suffering through the lockdown into two separate binary categories. The one that I say half in jest but is true is there are two types of people in the world, and those trying to have fun with the pandemic as best as they can, and those with little kids. And everybody I know with kids, it's a struggle to keep them occupied, to keep them busy, to teach, to get them to school. You know, we don't have any kids in the house, so it's just a much easier approach for us. So that's the joking binary outcome. The more serious binary outcome is, hey, if you're in the bottom 50-60% of the economic strata, your job is at greater risk, your health is at greater risk, the odds of you catching COVID-19 is increasably higher. It is, if you have the ability to flee to the suburbs or to a vacation property, and I know lots of folks from Manhattan, there's a great map in the New York Times I put up on the blog today showing where everybody has left New York for, both within the country and just, you know, in the suburbs of the city. It's not terrible. You're in a house, you're getting food deliveries, you have broadband, you're watching Netflix. The people in the top of the economic, I don't mean the top 1%, but the top 20-30%, this is a much easier situation for them. And that's been the great reveal of the coronavirus, is we know that there's great wealth inequality and we know that there's great income inequality, but it has never been starker. It has never been more obvious and blatant than it is for the people who have fled to the Hamptons and the Berkshires or wherever their vacation property is and are, you know, not having the worst time of it.
Yeah. I think that I wrote a blog post called Invisible. I think, you know, as we all went into our homes, the invisible became very visible.
Very much.
And it's been very difficult. You know, I kind of just wonder, like, how we come out of it as a society with so much inequality being exposed on a daily basis.
So,
do you think we change as people? Do we become better people, or we go back to being, you know, who we really are, self-centered?
That's a really interesting question, and there are two answers to that. I guess binary will be our theme today. What one answer is, you know, all these trends that were in place beforehand are now accelerating. I keep hearing people saying coronavirus is going to just change us completely, and I don't really see that as much as coronavirus is going to bring 2023, 2024, 2025 back to 2020 or 2021. All these trends that have been in place for a long time, we're going to see a lot more of. So the working from home, I've been working from home on Fridays for a couple of years. It's one less day of commuting, and it just starts the weekend earlier, and that sort of thing is going to be more common. Look, we've had FaceTime for a decade and a half. It's not a new technology. But between Zoom and other things, we're going to see more of that. So I think one change that's going to take place is All these pre-existing trends. Retail is a great example. Retail has been screwed for so long. The United States had something like 7 square feet, much more square foot of retail sales per capita than any other country in the world. We had wildly overbuilt retail. I wrote something about this in 07. So all these big retailers that are going out of business, the most recent one, Pier 1, is closing all its stores. These were trends that existed beforehand. The more intriguing question is whenever there's a giant disruption, very often the American public goes to the polls in November and votes for change. We're very much a, hey, we like a gridlock, we like a status quo, let's just let things progress until the shit hits the fan and then people say, hey, we really have to change. And I think there's a real chance that there's going to be a substantial change both at the state and federal level. Whether it's for the better or the worse, I'll let history determine. But whenever there is a big disruption, the Great Depression, world wars, things like that, the public votes for something new and something different. And this could be one of those events that leads to that sort of clean sweep. 5 months is forever in politics, and I'm not suggesting I have any idea what the outcome is going to be. I have a sneaking suspicion, but I'm not a political analyst, so that's just, you know, my own bias. But that said, we could see some pretty significant changes come November.
So, you know, I was talking to Howard Lindzen, and he said, Barry is the guy who can explain the economy, the markets, better than anybody else. And so let's put politics aside for a minute. You know, we may come back to it, but let's talk about what is going on in the stock markets. Like, everyone I know wants to know that we have a pandemic, we have 30 million jobs lost, and the market is going like it's 1999.
So you might be right that it is, you know, the last year of the expansion. That's a possibility. But I look at it as two key things that I think a lot of people are overlooking. The first is broader context, and the second is temporal, is time-related. So the broader context, the market started selling off in February 2020. March, the market reached its bottom. It fell 34% in about 4 weeks. That put it amongst the 20 worst months in history. Right? Think of it, go back 100 years, right? And think of how many months you have in a century. This was one of the 20 worst. So that really means it fell the fastest. It fell to 34%, the fastest. It's never happened that fast before in history. So sometimes you have to think about the market as a rubber band. And when that rubber band gets stretched too far in one direction, well, at a certain point, the selling becomes exhausted. You just run out of people to dump stocks, and then that creates an air pocket. It creates a void, and the market just fills that vacuum and comes snapping back. It doesn't mean it's going to stay back. The NASDAQ is within a few percent of its all-time highs. The Dow is still significantly lagging. The S&P is somewhat behind. But anytime you have something that the worst month, one of the worst months, historically, that tends to be followed by one of the best months. And that's exactly what happened. April was one of the best months. So the rubber band metaphor, over simplistic as it is, markets tend, you know, you have a market because things are two-sided. For every buyer, there's a seller. And it tends not to get wildly out of balance, except during moments when either tremendously new information comes in, or there is a huge emotional response, or both, an emotional response to new information. And so suddenly things completely change. What we believed on Monday is now thrown out on Tuesday. So that's the sort of technical answer. The more interesting philosophical answer goes something like this. Markets are this fantastic probabilistic mechanism. It is a future discounting mechanism that essentially takes all of the understanding of what's going on as expressed by people's buying and selling. And markets basically are a probabilistic bet about an unknown future outcome. And very often, so people are very much incentivized to find out what might happen before everybody else. And so very often that process leads markets as a whole to see things before it is officially released in the news. I've said before, news is old. By the time we release the first-time unemployment claims each week, that's already old data. It reflects the previous week. Each state assembles their first-time unemployment claims. So by the time we get to that Thursday release every week, it's backwards looking. It's telling you what the states have all assembled and sent to the Bureau of Labor Statistics a week ago. And that data isn't hidden. If you want to go out and reproduce that on your own, you can do that. So the market started selling off before GDP fell or officially fell. It sold off before unemployment ticked up dramatically. It fell before those first-time claims were announced, because it was easy enough to basically identify that information in advance, and people traded on it. Now what's happening, so that's February, March, as the market's selling off, all this bad news was visible. There are a couple other places where it was visible. Airline cancellations started very, very early. You know, if you and I travel a bit for work, we speak at conferences, we do stuff like that. In February and March, I was already waiting for events in May and June to get canceled or to get postponed or to become virtual. And so if you're following the airline industry and they report a 10 or a 20% uptick in cancellations, that information makes its way into the market before we know, hey, this is going to be a crazy shutdown and a lockdown in place and the economy is going to fall off a cliff. Now let's look at it on the recovery, on the other side. What's going on the other side? Well, long before the CARES Act and the $3 trillion was passed, and long before the Federal Reserve did their rate cut and their credit facilities, there was chatter about that. So by the time that's officially passed, it's already days or weeks old, and the market is clued into it. The market isn't always right. It's making a probabilistic bet, but it gets it more right than wrong most of the time. And so why are we screaming higher? Well, I'll give you a couple examples. First, you have all these different companies filing quarterly filings and other things with the SEC, especially if they're in the biotech or the pharmaceuticals area, talking about, hey, this is a material issue. We have a phase two test that looks encouraging for either treating the COVID virus or coming up with a vaccine, or I love this new RNA technology. It's not just about COVID. That's like a huge breakthrough that's going to affect a ton of different diseases. That shows up in a part of the market, and everybody in the market kind of knows eventually what everybody else knows, and so that starts to spread. You have that information. Examples of reopenings start to be perceived. And then if you look at NASDAQ, which is now up for the year, the Dow is still significantly way behind the NASDAQ. All these companies that had been the winner-take-all rock stars, Amazon and Apple and Netflix and Google, this not only isn't hurting them, this is helping them. It's kind of cementing their leadership because everybody is now relying on them. Walmart and Target, two very well-regarded retailers, their numbers are up dramatically. And so we're starting to see this bifurcation amongst publicly traded companies where there are some winners and then everybody else is a second fiddle. And so you see that in both the S&P 500, which is very top-heavy with the biggest stocks. I think this is the first time since the 1970s that the five biggest stocks in the S&P 500 comprise 20% of the index. And so the market screaming up isn't so much the market screaming up, it's really a handful of stocks pulling everybody else. And that's company. Look at Microsoft. You know, I was whining to you before about Microsoft Teams screws up my video for everything else, for Zoom, for Squadcast. But you know, they are a company that any enterprise is very comfortable saying, okay, run our show for us. You guys can do this. Microsoft is as profitable as they've ever been. They're a giant winner in this. Apple also is another giant winner. Go down the list of the biggest tech companies, even Amazon. I mentioned the other day, Amazon, since I've been stuck at home, I'm a lazy Amazon shopper. I need something. I go to Amazon, click, it's there in a day or two. It's easy. Since I'm at home and a little more lazy less lazy these days, I kind of comparison shop. And all of a sudden, things I want, hey, I could get this cheaper elsewhere. Although it's pretty ironic because half of the elsewhere uses Amazon payments as their processing. So Uncle Jeff still gets his pound of flesh.
As listening to you, as you know, I tell my friends, news is the lagging indicator of reality, and that's pretty much what the market thinks as well. You know, one of the more interesting things I learned in last month or so, as listening to somebody who said there are two kinds of signals: cheap signal and expensive signal. And he says the expensive signal, only very few people get to pick up. Everybody else gets cheap signal. And news is essentially cheap signals because we are all getting it much later. I wrote about the big tech gets bigger in this pandemic because it's no different than the JP Morgan and Citibank getting bigger in 2008, financial crisis. The question here is, what happens to the middle? I think you're making a really great point. We have a lot of companies which are on the one edge, which is the smaller companies. They're going to be doing interesting things. You know, companies like Shopify or Square, and they're coming from the small company side of things. And then there's the big boys, which are the big tech companies and big retailers, big box retailers like Walmart and Target. What happens to the big giant middle in your mind?
So, it's funny because back in the day, the Gaussian distribution of the long tail, what Amazon and other online retailers were bringing us, you didn't need a physical store with 100,000 titles. You could have an online store with tens of millions of titles. Well, when it comes to companies, there seems to be one or two leaders in the space, a handful of people nipping at their heels, and then a bunch of innovative and disruptive startups. So I can't tell you who's going to be the winner in self-driving cars. Right now, it looks like it's Tesla, but I don't know what high school kid starts MIT in 2 years and comes up with a breakthrough that becomes this is now the best technology for self-driving cars. That creative disruption, which is so cliched because it's true, look at the companies that are the leaders. They didn't exist 30 or 40 years ago. And if you look at every decade, go back to the 1970s and look at who the biggest stocks were. Half those companies don't exist, and a lot of the ones that still exist, IBM or General Electric or ExxonMobil, they're still big, viable companies, but they're nowhere near their size relative to the rest of the marketplace. So the nature of technology, the nature of capitalism, the nature of markets is constant change. It just takes place at a longer timeline than us humans are comfortable with. We live, minute to minute, second to second, day to day. Getting people to think about 10, 20, 30 years in the future has been a challenge. It's a challenge whether you're talking about global warming or whether you're trying to convince someone, hey, you need to save more money for your retirement. And so looking at these corporations, looking at these big companies, one of the biggest advantages of owning an index is you don't have to pick which companies to keep or to buy. The index does that automatically. When something is rising through the ranks, it shows up pretty early and gets put into the index. And when something falls from favor, it also eventually gets pulled out of the index. And as it falls, its weight actually is less and less because it's a market cap based system, and the smaller something becomes, the less significant it is. So that is the nature of investing in capitalism. Everything changes, and what you think is a forever company, think about the companies that have been around for centuries. You know, the beer brewers in Europe or in Japan. There are a few dozen companies that have survived for centuries. Most companies have a very finite lifespan.
Let's talk about the indexes then. You said earlier that in the S&P 500, there is like five companies that represent almost 20%,
right,
of the index. And like, how soon do we start to think differently about the S&P 500? Because if anything, this pandemic is showing that we might have put a full stop on the industrial era. Like, the industrial revolution might actually be brought to its knees finally by the virus. So why, and yet you look at S&P 500, there is a whole slew of companies which are from the past, right? They're not even of the present. They're just about the past. When do you think, you know, these indexes or indices, not indexes, my English teacher would have slapped me on that. And like, when do those change, right? You know, when do they evolve to kind of reflect the more tech-centric, more internet-centric reality?
Well, we've already seen that start. You know, look at who are amongst the biggest of the big. It's Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Google, Facebook. One of the things that's different today than in past decades is that we've kind of stopped antitrust enforcement. You know, back in the day, ExxonMobil started out as Standard Oil. ESSO was what ESSO with the dinosaur was what their logo was in the, I want to say, 40s, 50s, 60s. ESSO became Exxon, and eventually Exxon merged with Mobil. But, you know, we broke up Standard Oil. We broke up U.S. Steel. We broke up all these companies that had a dominant market position. And that sort of began to change in the 80s and got throttled back a little bit. Back to Microsoft, they had their antitrust enforcement because they were killing the internet. They were basically saying, you can't innovate because anything you do, we're going to make our 97% market share operating system. We're either going to make the default our product, or we're going to basically make a copy of your idea and build it into us. It's a good thing that antitrust enforcement came along, because as soon as that basically slowed Microsoft down, that's when the Cambrian explosion on the internet really took off. And I think if you like Facebook, and if you like YouTube, and you like all of Netflix and all these new technologies, I think you kind of had to tie one hand behind Microsoft's back before these companies really exploded. And I guess you can include Google in that as well. And we could thank Microsoft for bailing out Apple. Their $150 million loan and their investment and their deal with Apple saved Apple. So they wanted a viable competitive operating system, and they got one. So that antitrust enforcement, you know, I don't know if we need to break up Amazon or if we need to break up Facebook or Google. Folks like Professor Galloway at NYU, who wrote the book The Four, has very much been saying these companies have gotten too good, too big for our good. It's great for them. It's not necessarily great for us. And so that's something that needs to be really thought about pretty seriously.
You know, so there is that Google, rumors of Google antitrust action, you know, going around, and, you know, that would be an interesting one to see. Though I personally think more than Google, they should be worried more about Facebook, because I think Facebook is actually a much more predatory company than Google is. And I think they cause more long-term harm to the web and the open internet ecosystem than Google does. I mean, I'm not saying Google is, is like, completely Puritan. But I just think between shades of gray, I think, Facebook is definitely the dark force.
So the interesting pushback to a Google or a Facebook is, hey, no one has to use Google. There are a dozen other search engines. There are hundreds of them. You don't want to use Google? Find a different search engine. You're not locked in, which is a reasonable argument. I've noticed over the past couple of years how the first page of Google used to be clean. It would be one little ad off to the side and then a whole bunch of search results. And now it's just festooned with shit. It's just littered with crap. That first page of Google is just somebody saying, all right, we want to see more profits. Let's put more ads on this. The more they junk up that page, maybe that creates an opportunity for a competitor to sneak in and say, better than Google, cleaner, and we don't bury you with sponsored stuff, and we don't put our own. It's a page out of Microsoft. The difference is a dominant operating system that was the plumbing of the computer. Now you could go to Google. You don't have to go to Google. I agree with you that Facebook is where Microsoft used to be the evil empire. They've kind of mellowed in their old age, and now Facebook is the evil empire. I spend as little time on Facebook and its products as possible, and I make sure anytime I'm on Facebook or Instagram, I log out when I'm done, because otherwise they are just following you around like a stalker wherever you go. I know they tend to deny this, but my experience has been I get a lot less of those annoying ads that follow you through the internet if I'm out of Facebook and not looking at stuff. And plus, I completely agree with you. They are reckless and irresponsible in how they treat fake news, dangerous news. That they should have a zero tolerance for bad information on COVID, on the anti-vaxxers. Listen, it's a private company. No one has the right to go onto their platform and spew bullshit, especially if you're a Russian intelligence officer or a bot or some of these other things. They've done a horrific job policing their own. You put on Fox News, you're going to get a mix of some regular news and some just crazy nonsense. You shouldn't get that from Facebook, but Facebook as a platform has been completely weaponized. They never understood the risk factors, and we don't just see that in the United States. You see that all around the world. I'm pretty happy not – I haven't killed my Facebook account, but I am on there so rarely. And every time I go on Facebook, I'm just aghast at what I see, and I'm shocked that they're still as popular as they are. That said – everybody I know who has done any form of targeted advertising within the platform can't help but rave as to how precise they can target exactly the audience you want. Geographically, economically, it's amazing, and that's why they're such a powerhouse company. So personally, I hate the product. Professionally, I'm impressed with what assassins they are within the advertising space.
Well, they are counting on the biggest fallacy in our modern society, every man for himself. Like every company is looking at their own self-interest, not at the greater good. We are seeing it all around us, like whether it's wearing masks or like doing isolation or like staying 6 feet apart. People are not doing any of those things just because they all think, it's not my problem, it's somebody else's problem. And I think a society is, going to suffer because of that. And I think Facebook has only, just amplified that behavior. I think that's what it really is. I killed my Facebook account 2.5 years ago. And I'm so happy that I still am on Instagram, but I only, again, choose to go there once a week for like maybe 15, 20 minutes. And it's the same thing with WhatsApp because my mom is on WhatsApp and I can't help but being on WhatsApp despite my best efforts. I can't escape the clutches of the evil empire. You know, the thing which is really painful to observe about that company is that they keep doing things with impunity, and the media keeps falling for their techniques that, you know, we are better, we've changed, we've improved, we are more conscious, and, you know, we are a better corporate citizen. And it's all bullshit. Like, it's 100% nonsense. And, you know, like, yesterday they announced this deal with Shopify, and I was like, how long before Shopify kind of realizes that they've been hacked? I mean,
well, everybody who does a deal with Facebook eventually reaches that conclusion. Like,
yeah, they're like the Taliban, you know, in many ways. Like, it's like no one's winning except them. That's it. That's all they care about.
You know, the fascinating thing to me about Facebook, and specifically in the internet generally, when you and I were kids, every town had that sort of lone guy walking around muttering to himself, a little bit crazy. Sometimes he would be in the public library researching stuff. You didn't want to ask him about the government. They're eavesdropping, listening to my thoughts. That's literally where the tinfoil hat thing comes from. It stops the government from hearing your thoughts. And if each town in America had a couple of people like that, they were dispersed. They kind of kept to themselves, and they really didn't matter. Thanks to Facebook and the internet, now all these crazies manage to find each other. So the resurgence of people who are convinced the earth is flat, that's kind of amusing. It's not all that dangerous, except for the guy who built a rocket and met his demise trying to prove the earth was flat. But anti-vaxxers are one of those things that, you know, the science is pretty well understood how that false meme came about through a now withdrawn and discredited paper by a doctor who lost his license to practice because of the things he did that were inappropriate and improper. That is only possible through the internet. It is only possible through things like Facebook groups where like-minded people who would otherwise be forced to just mutter to themselves as they walk the streets, they get reinforced and they find support from other people who similarly believe the same really silly, foolish, disproven nonsense. There's a wonderful book. I'm drawing a blank on the author's name, but the book title is The Heretics of Science. And this author goes out and interviews all these and really embeds himself in all these like wacky groups. So it's not just flat earthers and anti-vaxxers. It's Holocaust deniers, and it's just a range of crazy, what you would think is crazy people. And it turns out these folks aren't so much crazy as they have a basic flaw in their internal model of the world. And from that, it's like aiming at the moon. If you're off by an inch or two at the launch, well, you're going to miss it by thousands and thousands of miles. If your fundamental premise is deeply flawed, well, everything you build on top of that, that foundation is going to lean to a terrible edifice. And Facebook is the perfect entity to reinforce that sort of bad belief system over and over again.
So what I was going to say to you is, like, I remember talking to you a long time ago. You were just about to launch your blog, and you pinged me to ask me about, like, what, you know, how you should write, what you should write, yada, yada, yada. That was like a long time ago.
Are we talking about the TypePad blog in 03 or the WordPress blog in 08? And before TypePad was Yahoo GeoCities. That's how old I am.
No, not GeoCities. This was like, I think you were on TypePad at that time.
Yeah.
And that was our conversation. But I want to ask you, what's your advice for current or aspiring bloggers today? Because I'm not a very active blogger like the way you are. I'm turning the tables on you.
Sure. So you have a couple of choices, but really there's a couple of really interesting things. You know, you have to give people a reason to read your shit. There's a book out and a blog post out with the title "No One Wants to Read Your Shit," quote unquote, really the name of a post. And you have to give people a compelling reason to say, you know, it's not, even if it's free, it's not the cost in dollars, it's the cost in time. And so you have to give people a reason to say, I like what this person has to say. I think their process is very, very specific. And I think their track record is good enough that if they say something I disagree with, I'm not just going to shrug it off and say, no, I have a different belief. I'm going to think about it because there's some value to their approach that's going to make me think about something I might not have thought of in a specific way. So I think that's what you need to do. Not just, and really there are three things you can do on a blog. I mean, there's a million things, but they really boil down to three key things. One is you can curate other content. And I've been doing that for 20 years. I start my day with, you know, about 100 different sources and I whittle them down to 10 reads. There are a lot of people who do curation like that. The second is you can create original content, and I enjoy doing that. It's a little bit of a compulsion also to, hey, I have something that's bothering me and I have to get this out of me. And then the third thing you can do is really, I don't know if criticism is the same. By the way, within original content, that includes conversations like this. This is original content. And interviews. And I think that's part of the reason podcasts have blown up as much as they have, because it's very interesting original content and you're not sitting in front of a TV. You could be doing anything in a car, on a treadmill, out for a walk. That's what makes the audio side of that. And then the third thing is you could go out and you can, whether it's original or not, you can educate and teach people. And that's something very, very different. Sometimes that takes the form of explaining why the dominant thought about something is incorrect. Sometimes it gets more specific. This column is nonsense, and here's why. And sometimes it's just trying to get people to look at the world from a different perspective. And so if you can do any of those things, if you can create, if you can curate, or if you can educate, any of those three blocks are going to be give people a reason to come to whatever your site is and read you. And the people I read on a regular basis are just masters at that. And just, it's amazing. My partners make fun of me when I say this because they think I'm like, you know, Panglossian. But really, there has never been, he says, in the middle of a pandemic lockdown, there has never been a better time to be a human being on this planet. What's available to you for practically free, the quality of things, it's astonishing. It is just, you know, think back a few hundred years ago. I don't mean thousands of years ago. I mean the 1600s, and a handful of people were allowed access to books, at least in the Western world. It was different in the Eastern world back then. Today, you have access to basically everything ever written, recorded, videotaped. It's amazing. And I think if people aren't taking advantage of it, they're missing something that is just spectacular.
All right. Before we go, who are you reading?
Oh, God. I have a list of people. I read everything they write.
Top three.
Well, I'm going to give you more than three. I'll give you I'll insult too many if I only give you three. So Jason Zweig, not counting the guys in my office, like Mike Batnick and Ben Carlson, and Nick Majuli and Josh Brown. I mean, I work with some of the most talented writers, and I'm leaving people out in finance. Morgan Housel and Jason Zweig. Morgan writes for Collaborative Fund. Zweig writes for the Wall Street Journal. Every week, whatever they put out, I have to digest. Derek Thompson at The Atlantic, everything he writes is a must read. Bethany McLean at Vanity Fair, her stuff is just fantastic. Her books are great. I just love everything she puts out. Dan Gross, who used to be with Slate and now is with, I'm trying to remember the name of the consulting company. Anything he puts out, you know, absolutely must read. There are probably a dozen other people that I could go through that if they have something to say. Judd Legum, lately I've been loving what he's been writing at Popular Information. He's just so incredibly insightful. And not only is he insightful, but his words actually have an impact and affect change. He's the one who got Kroger to start paying sort of combat pay for the people on the front lines dealing with the public delivering groceries, because he basically lambasted them and pointed out that they had said some stuff and then quietly backed away from it, and he held them accountable. So folks like that are just really, really fascinating, interesting people. And I should really put a list up on my site. There's probably 20 people that no matter what they write, I have to read every word of it.
That's pretty awesome. Thank you, Barry. It's great to catch up. You know, if there is...
Same here.
I'm glad we got a chance to just talk, and hopefully I will see you soon in New York.
Yeah. How are things in San Francisco? Have things kind of chilled out there during the lockdown, or is it as mayhem as ever?
Yeah, it's a little bit chill. You know, people are not as out on the streets as you would think. It's not like LA, but you know, it's good. Like people are, you know, paying attention to what the authorities are telling them, but I think everybody's getting antsy. Today is like my day 82 of the quarantine, and I'm kind of, I need some human interactions now.
Let me shock you with this thing I discovered this morning. Do you know that this weekend is Memorial Day weekend? How the hell did that happen?
You know, it's one big giant blob of time, right?
Right. The days of the week don't matter anymore.
But you know what? This is what breaks them up for me, is like catching up with friends like you. So really great to see you.
Same here.
Yeah. Thanks, Barry.
Thanks so much for having me. Good to see you. Can't wait to see you again in either New York or San Francisco.